Okay, so digital copyright. I mean, it can be a bit of a jungle out there, especially if you're a law student just starting to grapple with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA.
Oh yeah, it's a real new spinner sometimes.
Well, today we're going to get into the weeds with a case that really put the DMCA's anti-circumvention rules on the map. 321 Studios v. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios. This 2004 decision is a landmark case, folks, and it's essential reading for anyone who wants to understand how the law views breaking those digital locks, even if you think you have a good reason, like making a personal backup.
Yeah, this case really drove home the idea that those digital safeguards have some serious legal weight behind them.
So we're going to do a full deep dive here, looking at what went down in this case, the legal arguments that were thrown around, and most importantly, what it means for the DMCA and for digital content in general.
Right, because let's be honest, this stuff is constantly evolving.
Absolutely. And we've got some great sources to guide us. A super detailed case brief, a standard case summary, and some expert advice just for us. So before we get too deep, can we just start with the basics? What exactly was 321 Studios doing that got them in trouble with the movie studios?
Well, 321 Studios was all about software marketing and selling it, and they had a couple of products that really got under the skin of the movie industry, DVD Copy Plus and DVD X Copy Y. Those are the big ones. And the main thing these programs did was crack the Content Scramble System, or CSS, the encryption that was used on pretty much every DVD back then.
CSS. Okay, I think we need to break that down a bit for those who might not be totally familiar with the tech side of things. What exactly was CSS and why did it become the central point in this legal battle?
Yeah, good point. So CSS was kind of a two-for-one deal when it came to protecting DVDs. First and foremost, it was an access control, like a digital balancer. You needed a DVD player that could speak CSS, had the right key to even watch the movie. But, and this is important, it also acted as a copy control, a way to stop people from making unauthorized copies of the content. So CSS was basically controlling who could watch and who could copy.
So it was protecting the content from both unauthorized viewing and copying. Interesting.
Exactly. And 321 Studios, they knew they were wading into some tricky legal waters, so they decided to take a preemptive strike, so to speak.
But they went on the offensive. Interesting strategy. How did they do that?
They went to court seeking a declaratory relief, essentially asking the court to rule that their software didn't break either the DMCA or copyright law.
Bold move. So, what were their main arguments? How could they possibly justify cracking that CSS encryption?
Well, they had a few arrows in their quiver. They claimed that their software had plenty of legitimate, non-infringing uses, that it was all about enabling fair use. They even brought up some constitutional issues, freedom of speech, that sort of thing.
Okay, so they came out swinging. Now, how did the major movie studios, the big guys like MGM, respond to this? What was their side of the story?
The movie studios were not messing around. They argued straight up. The 321 Studio software was a clear violation of the DMCA's anti-circumvention provisions. They saw it as a direct attack on their copyrights, plain and simple.
So you have this clash of perspectives, right? The software company saying, hey, we're just helping people exercise their fair use rights, make personal backups. And then you have the copyright holders saying, hold on, you're undermining our entire business model by breaking our digital locks.
Exactly. And that brings us to the heart of this whole case, the DMCA itself.
Right, we need to get into the legal nitty-gritty here.
Yeah.
Can you break down the specific parts of the DMCA that the court really honed in on in this case?
Absolutely. The court zeroed in on two key subsections of Section 1201 of the DMCA. First up, you have Section 1201A2. This one says you can't traffic in any tech, any product, any service if it's primarily designed to get around tech measures that control access to a copyrighted work. It's about breaking through that first digital barrier, like we talked about with CSS.
So A2 is about getting your foot in the door, so to speak. What about the other section?
The second one is Section 1201B1, and this one deals with tech that's designed to circumvent protections that safeguard the copyright owner's rights, like making copies or distributing the work. So once you're past the initial access hurdle, B1 kicks in to protect the copyright holder's exclusive rights.
Okay, so A2 is about getting in, and B1 is about what you can do once you're in. Got it. And the court really scrutinized the language in these sections, didn't they?
Yeah, they were parsing every word, looking at terms like primarily designed, limited commercial purpose other than to circumvent, and marketed for use in circumventing. These phrases are like the keys to the DMCA kingdom.
So it's not just about whether a tool can be used to bypass protections, but whether that's its main purpose and how it's being sold to people.
Precisely. intent matters. Mm-hmm. So with that legal framework in mind, let's get into the meat of the court's decision. Why did they ultimately side with the movie studios and against 321 studios?
Yeah, let's break it down.
Okay, so the court was very clear in their rejection of 321 studios' arguments. One of the biggest points of contention was the fair use defense. The court basically said, look, the DMCA, as it stands, doesn't have a special carve-out for fair use when it comes to these anti-circumvention rules.
So even if someone have a legitimate fair use reason, like making a backup copy for personal use, the act of breaking that digital lock to do it could still be a DMCA violation.
That's right. The court was drawing a distinction between using copyrighted material fairly and circumventing tech protections to get to that fair use. It's like saying you can eat the cake, but you can't break into the bakery to get it.
That's a pretty vivid analogy. So what about the argument that consumers just wanted to watch their legally purchased DVDs in a different format, maybe on a device that doesn't play DVDs? That seems reasonable, right?
Well, 321 Studios definitely pushed that preferred format angle, but the court wasn't buying it. They said there's no right to copy copyrighted material in any specific format, even if it's just for personal convenience. And they had this really impactful line. Fair use has never been a guarantee of access in the format of the original.
Wow, that's pretty definitive. So the court basically said, tough luck, you bought the DVD, you watch it on a DVD player.
Pretty much. Now, 321 Studios also tried to play the constitutional card, arguing that the DMCA was stifling free speech or overstepping Congress's power.
Okay, so they went for the big guns. Did that work?
Not really. The court didn't see the software code as pure expression, more like a functional tool. So no First Amendment protection there. And as for the Commerce Clause argument, they basically pointed to the DVD market and said, look, this is clearly interstate commerce, so Congress has every right to regulate it.
So the court shut down all of 321 Studios' major arguments and firmly upheld the DMCA's anti-circumvention provisions. What did this mean in practice? Does it stop people from making backup copies of their DVDs?
Well, technically, yes. According to the court, making a backup copy of a DVD by getting around that CSS encryption is a DMCA no-no. Now, whether that's actively enforced against every single person who does it is another story.
Yeah.
But the legal precedent is there.
Right. It sets the standard. This whole issue reminds me of something I've heard called the analog hole. Can you explain what that is? It sounds like some kind of legal loophole.
It's definitely a bit of a head scratcher. Basically, the analog hole refers to this weird situation where it's usually legal to copy something if you're doing it from an analog source. Like back in the day, recording a movie from your TV onto a VHS tape was perfectly fine. But if you try to do the same thing digitally, circumventing encryption to make a copy, suddenly it's illegal, even if the end result is the same, a personal copy.
So the law cares more about how you make the copy than what you do with it, in a sense. That seems a little odd.
It does highlight how the DMCA is really focused on protecting those digital locks, those digital rights management technologies. Now, this 321 Studios case is from 2004. Does it still hold any weight today, given how much tech has changed since then?
Yeah, it seems like ancient history in tech terms.
Oh, it's still hugely relevant.
Yeah.
The principles laid out in this case are still being used to interpret the DMCA in all sorts of new contexts. Think about jailbreaking smartphones, modding game consoles. These things often involve circumventing digital protections. Mm. And this case is part of the legal foundation for how those actions are viewed.
So it's not just about DVDs anymore. It's about controlling access to all sorts of digital content.
Exactly. Now, there were some people who criticized rulings like this, arguing that they could stifle innovation, limit consumer rights. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it seems like there's a balance to be struck between protecting creators and giving consumers some freedom.
Absolutely. Critics argued that these strict anti-circumvention rules could discourage the development of new technologies that might work with existing content or give users more control over the stuff they buy. It's a valid concern. It's interesting, though, even the court in this case acknowledged that CSS wasn't a particularly strong form of protection. But they still said, nope, tools to bypass it are a no-go under the DMCA.
So they basically drew a line in the sand, even if the protection being bypassed wasn't that tough to crack. This whole discussion reminds me of another big case, Sony Betamax. That case established this substantial non-infringing use standard. Why didn't that precedent apply here?
That's a great question, and it gets to the heart of how the DMCA is different from traditional copyright law. Sony Betamax was all about contributory copyright infringement under the regular Copyright Act. The question there was whether a tech, in that case the Betamax VCR, had enough legitimate uses to outweigh the potential for infringement.
So in Sony, It was about whether the device itself would lead to widespread copyright violations. But in 321 Studios, the focus was specifically on the DMCA's anti-circumvention rules, whether or not any actual copyright infringement happened. Just offering the tool to break the lock was enough.
Exactly. The DMCA created a whole new type of liability. So even if a device could be used for legal purposes, if its main purpose is circumvention, it's in trouble.
So the DMCA kind of operates on its own track, separate from traditional copyright analysis. That's a key takeaway for anyone studying IP law.
Totally. And for future lawyers, remember, even if a tech has some legitimate uses, if it's mainly designed for circumvention and it's marketed that way, it could still face legal challenges under the DMCA.
That's some solid advice. Well, this has been a really insightful deep dive into a really important case. It's clear that 321 Studios v. MGM is still a cornerstone of how we understand the DMCA and the whole debate around digital rights. And as you mentioned, this area of law is always evolving. I mean, we see new battles popping up all the time, like with the right to repair movement, where people are fighting for the right to tinker with their own devices, even if it means breaking digital locks. And then you have the whole world of AI, where companies are scraping data from the internet to train their algorithms. And that raises a ton of copyright questions.
Oh, absolutely. The legal landscape is constantly shifting, but the principles we've discussed today provide a solid foundation for navigating these new challenges. It's all about finding that balance between protecting creators and promoting innovation, and that's a debate that's not going away anytime soon.
Well said. Okay, listeners, here's a final thought for you to chew on, especially if you're in law school. How do you think the DMCA's anti-circumvention rules will need to adapt in the future, given how fast technology is moving and how sophisticated these digital locks are becoming? How can we protect creators, encourage innovation, and respect user rights all at the same time? It's a tough question, but it's one worth pondering as you continue your legal journey. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to geek out about the DMCA.
Anytime. Until next time, folks, keep on learning and stay curious.